religious clergy trends today, pre-pictured in the French Revolution and what lies ahead, is pretty much our kind of ungainly title for what we're going to consider here. Brother Russell, in the fourth volume, page 533, says this, quote, "In all these leading causes which culminated in the terrors of the French Revolution, we see a strong resemblance to similar conditions today, which are rapidly and surely leading to the foretold similar results on a worldwide scale. Mark the growing animosity between the privileged classes, royalty and aristocracy, and the working classes, the discussions of the rights and wrongs of the people, and the decline of respect for both civil and ecclesiastical authority. Note also the revolutionary current of popular thought and expression, the increasing dissatisfaction of the masses of the people with the ruling powers and the institutions of government." End of quote. A few pages later, on the fourth volume, page 538, just a little point, quote, "In no work of the French Revolution is this its retributive character more strikingly or solemnly apparent than in its dealings with the Roman Church and papal power." So, end of quote. So, that is, I believe, in essence, our assignment, is to look back briefly at what happened in the French Revolution regarding the religious element in the clergy, and then note trends of today, and look at scriptures. And the way I think we're going to try to do it for ourselves is look at scriptures that deal with the French Revolution in Revelation and make comparisons to scriptures in Revelation that we think talk about what has happened and yet still to happen. I have a very simple concept in my mind, and it's that if, according to Revelation 11, 13, one-tenth of the city fell in the earthquake, and that was France. And look what they did in France during the Reign of Terror, which is the prototype specifically, then how much worse has nine-tenths of the city, when it falls, going to be? That's a simple equation in my mind. And Brother Russell, in the quotes I just read, he said, what happened in the French Revolution prefigures what's going to happen on a worldwide scale. And when we think that what happened in the French Revolution, because it was almost completely papal, the retributive judgment on the Protestant denominations for their sins against light hasn't really been fulfilled as yet. So, as Brother Russell, in that quote we read, the retributive nature of all of the sins against light and misrepresentation of God's character that the churches, churchanity is a phrase I like to use, churchanity has fostered in the name of God and Christ, and then all the iniquitous practices along with that, as well as the whoredom of aligning themselves with any political entities, feeling that they should be ruling now before they recognize Christ has set up his kingdom, and he's the one ruler that they should have been united to as a chaste virgin church. So their whoredoms of being united with any political parties is also to their detriment as sin against light, because it's plain in scripture that they were to wait for the proper king's return, for him to take his reign. You know, it's a pretty simple concept to me, that's the picture that Brother Russell was bringing out with the French Revolution. Now, as well as the pages in the fourth volume brought out in the program, I'm going to also add that I found just as helpful in the third volume, 10 pages there, 49 to 59. So the third volume, C, 49 through 59, is excellent on events leading up to the time of the end, which is really the focus there in that setting. The religion and clergy in France, slightly before and during the revolution, the first is, let me stop for a second. You know, I was listening to the presentations yesterday and today, and I'm listening and I'm looking at the numbers on different things, and I'm thinking, well, that's close. I saw that number, but I picked this number or this or that. It's not hard and fast. But the brethren have done a great job, better than I will, of really bringing out some of the numerics here involved. So if you hear me say a number, it's just what, there were some choices. And they probably chose the better ones. But the first estate is really the church, which was the papacy in France and her clergy. And that was basically about 130,000, which they considered ordained or of the ecclesiastical orders, 130,000. Now, there's about 28 million in France. So the first estate, in other words, a very small sliver of the population, 130,000 compared to 28 million, 23,000 monks, 60,000 curates and vicars, 37,000 nuns. They had 2,500 monasteries, 1,500 convents, and 60,000 churches and chapels all in France. So that kind of gives you like a very brief rundown of that. But the main point, about 130,000 were the first estate. The second estate is brought out was nobility, and the third estate, with by far the majority, was the common people, the tradespeople, the peasantry. But the first estate, the religious element, was really divided in two classes. The higher clergy versus the lower clergy. The lower clergy was the bulk of that. Now, what was the difference? The higher clergy would have been popes, cardinals, bishops, archbishops. The lower clergy would have been more of your priests, monks, nuns, friars. But some of the second estate nobility, as was brought out, were not particularly well off themselves. They were born into noble families, but they still had to make a living somehow. They didn't have enough money. So a lot of those nobles chose to go into the first estate, go in to join the church, be part of become an ecclesiast, because it was an easy way of life if you were nobility and you were living in a large city like Versailles or Paris, so that they were enjoying the high life like nobility, even though they were clerics. But the lower and the bulk, the lower clergy, and that was the majority of them, they really came from the third estate. They were of the peasantry class or the trades class. They were ones who actually had a stronger bond with the people in the villages and small towns and hamlets, and they were actually much more compassionate in general than the clergy that was enjoying the high life and the prestige of the larger cities. So when the vengeance and retributive judgment was handed down in the Reign of Terror portion of the French Revolution, it was more aimed toward those that were in the larger cities, those that were perceived by the populace as really enjoying the high life at their expense of the poor. The weird thing about all of this is that the land holdings of the first estate, the church in France, was pictured between, I've read 10%, I've also read 15%. But the first estate was basically tax exempt. Now, what it means being a 10 to 15% landholder, it wasn't just being a landholder, they held the best of the land, along with some of the nobility. So it was prosperous land. It was land that had tenant farmers who would pay a rent, as it were, to the clergy who owned those properties. They also would go to church, as it were, and they'd have to pay their tithes. Usually at 10% was the goal, but not hardly any of them could make it because they were so poor. So the church made money in that way, as well as what different indulgences were sold. And then they also made a certain amount of money from what the land produced itself beyond, thus the rent from the tenement farmers and such. In fact, they were making so much money that went untaxed, that the state, the government, through a lot of vigorous debate, finally settled on an approximately 2% of their church's income to be paid to the state, not as a tax, but it was a considered a gift, an annual gift. They fought over it, and that's what they ended up giving, and then that money was used to help the people. Now, the church had a peculiar role. It was in charge of education of the people. It was in charge of helping those in poverty. It was in charge of marriages, funerals, the baptisms, the birth, as well as the hereafter. So they had prominent roles in that. Now, the higher element, like cardinals and the pope and the archbishops, they were consultants to the nobility class, the king and others. And I don't think it was said, but from what I read, out of these three estates, which just about covered everybody in France, I don't know if this was said or not, but from what I read, the king was not one of the three estates. He was alone. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. But when I was reading this, the three estates, I couldn't help but think of India and the caste system. And it was very similar, because the top caste was the Hindu priests. Then you had your military and your rulers, the kings, the rajas. And then you're down in the third caste with merchants and trades, and then your bottom caste in India, the fourth, is the untouchables, which just did all the other disagreeable work. So, I have to say that again, fallen human nature finds its ways to try to categorize people and put them in their positions. And those that are in positions of power usually feel entitled. And that's exactly what the church helped the nobility to feel. Entitled, particularly the king and his family. Entitled of the divine right of kings. So it was a cozy relationship dating back to Charlemagne, as we know, that it was the papacy of the city of the bestower of crowns, outlined in Isaiah 23. And that's what they were doing up to the time of Napoleon, as we know, more or less. And this was the point of why the church was enjoying such a position, is because they were enforcing on the common people that your king has God's, under God's direction to be your ruler. And so the king, in essence, if he was too hard on the popes, and it was not to his advantage on one hand, because this is the very one saying he has the right to rule. So you see how they had to play with each other a little bit, but at the time of the French Revolution, that came to an end. That was a tremendous blow in France. Now, one of the other benefits of being part of the clergy is you weren't called into the military, so you did not have to serve in the military. If you were part of the clergy in France at that time, you wouldn't be tried in a civil court. You would have an ecclesiastical court, as it were, a trial by your peers. But that wasn't very satisfactory, and it didn't really happen that often. And that, too, came to an end in the French Revolution. But it does remind us that that traditional thinking of the papacy dies hard with all the sex abuse cases against priests and others in the Catholic Church in a variety of countries, and how they try to shuttle around any type of responsibility to civil law in the different lands that they were in. But it was basically lawsuits that actually started to bring this thing down. And, of course, we've seen it here in the United States. It's still ongoing, and it's still being satisfied. A lot of things happen. I think that was one of the main reasons that Pope Benedict, the previous pope to this one, also known as Ratzinger, I think that's why he stepped down. I think it was being realized and was going to be made public that he had signed different kind of letters and his knowledge of pedophile priests being shifted around by different bishops. And that would have been such a huge embarrassment that they had him go into retirement, bring in this new pope, and this new pope is doing a bit of a reform work along this line as part of the Jezebel painting her face picture. So a lot of this goes on, and you know, there's always what's out there for the public gist, but then it's what's really going on behind the scenes. And there was a huge upheaval. One of the most Catholic countries in recent times was Ireland, and the Catholic Church was still had been in charge of most of the public education system and enjoyed a lot of benefits in Ireland until just a few years ago, when it became revealed that at the not only the sexual abuses, but child labor misuse and the abuse of children in different Catholic style, like orphanages and poorhouses. When it all came out, the papacy just took a major hit in Ireland, and they voted them out of a lot of the power positions that they had. It was quite a big deal. Now here in America, we would just read that news very lightly, but if you're in Ireland and you're reading it from the Irish perspective, this is really a major upheaval that took place, and that was under Benedict, not under this current pope. So that was interesting. Okay. I'm just going to drop down to the essence of French life, and it's a sentence that I read in preparing for this, but I thought it was such a good summation. The state, or the second estate, taught men what to do. The first estate, the church, taught men what to believe. And as for man, the third estate, his business was to be told what to do and what to believe. And that was it. And that was French life in general. Until, of course, as brought out, the philosophers came forward with the ideas of the rights of man and liberty. And that, of course, set the stage it was the Lord's time for a radical change. But that was, in a very simplified way, how the French had viewed life and had been under that system for almost 1,000 years. The first estate, the clergy, wielded considerable ideological power and political influence in France due to the strong religious beliefs of the majority of the population. The church was also incredibly wealthy. It was a significant owner of land, collected rents and tithes, yet avoided paying any significant amount of tax to the state, 2% as we had mentioned. On the eve of the French Revolution, the papal church was subject to disillusionment and criticism from within and from without. These criticisms could be found within the ranks of the church by the lower clergy, as it were, because they were identifying with the population, the peasantry, who just at the outset of the worst part of the French Revolution, most dramatic part, there was famine in the land. And the people were starving, and they were having difficulties trying to just put food on the table. And the lower priests, as it were, and the lower clergy, they were sympathetic to that. But nonetheless, their calls for reform in the upper part of the church basically went unheeded. Now, I truly enjoyed the preceding presentations, as I had said, and I thought in my mind along the way, too, that I would pick and choose a little bit over what we'd say to try to eliminate as much repetition as possible, knowing that there'd be some overlap. I'm going to jump in here. These are quotes from the third volume, pages 49 to 59. I said that earlier, but instead of these quotes being from a specific page, I've kind of blended a few things. So it's all brother. What I'm reading now is from Brother Russell, but it's in those 10 pages. All right. Quote: "Of course, such a reaction from such a cause would be to infidelity. France suddenly became thoroughly infidel under the influence of Voltaire and associates, who deluged the country with their writings, hurling contempt and ridicule upon Christianity, or rather upon the apostate Church of Rome, which was the only Christianity with which the French people were acquainted. They pointed out its falsehoods, absurdities, hypocrisies and immoralities, its cruelties and all its wickedness, until the French people became as inflamed in the zeal to exterminate Catholicism and all religion as they had formerly been zealous to uphold it. And miserable, deluded France for 1,000 years, completely under the influence of the papacy, supposing that the Christ and not the Antichrist had been her despicable master, cried out in the words of Voltaire, 'Down with the wretches!' And their effort to down the excusable Antichrist resulted in all the horrors of the French Revolution, a wonderful illustration of the retributive justice when viewed in comparison with the dreadful massacres of St. Bartholomew's Day of Protestants and similar occasions incited and rejoiced over by the papacy. Skipping down a little bit, again quoting from Brother Russell, we hear in truth the remark that the French Revolution is prominently pointed out in the Book of Revelation, which clearly show that the closing trouble upon all the nations of Christendom was illustrated in that reign of terror. That pestilence of infidelity and anarchism, which spread from France the world over, was fed and fattened upon the false, unscriptural doctrines and practices of Christendom, represented not only in papacy, but in orthodoxy generally. Nominal Christianity has not cured this malady and is powerless to avert its further outbreak, predicted in the scriptures to be the greatest trouble the world ever to know. End of quote. So that's where we're going to spend more time looking in Revelation at what the scriptures have talked about symbolically of what happened with the French Revolution along a certain line. Because here again, this is kind of a simplified matter in my mind. The focus of the French Revolution to us is what was in Revelation. What did God highlight for us there? And then let's look at comparisons of what the Lord God has highlighted in the Book of Revelation of what is probable yet to come, and see if we see comparisons. And we will also want to track some trends. So I'm going to move along to that line and just leave it down to the point that in essence of what we saw in the French Revolution was a retributive judgment by an oppressed people of an overbloated, wealthy, ecclesiastical system that had lived to their advantage over the poor, had cooperated in full agreement with the state in governing over the people, and instead of truly representing Christ and Christianity and God in the benevolent rulership with the people, the hierarchy took advantage of their positions, and they lived a very haughty lifestyle, as it were. Now, one could go, you know, reasonable minds could go about this in several different ways. I think I'm going to take a look at some of the current trends of recent times. And these trends regarding the Pope and the papacy and it's really Orthodox Christianity in general, but while 1914 saw the end of the Gentile times and the bulk of the monarchies were removed, and the concept that those monarchs were ruling by divine right was gone, it didn't remove the concept that many Christians and Christian denominations today still feel that Christians should be in government. They have the concept that as God in the Old Testament with Israel had a theocracy ruling over the people, so too, and how much more so, should Christians and countries that are predominantly Christian, even nominal in nature, should have a Christian leadership, should have Christian leadership in government. The papacy, which is a country, and they have their head is both civil and religious. The Anglican Church claims that their head is both civil and religious. So we still have the ten horn and two horn beast, as it were, with us that are claiming those kind of positions of power. But the papacy has gone up and down since 1914 as far as any type of influence in the world. It's not a smooth path. It's been a roller coaster. The fall of the monarchies in 1914 and such, of course, a crushing blow on one hand. Yet in 1929, Mussolini in Italy restored much of the wealth to the papacy, and actually the Italian people loved him for bringing the papacy back into prominence to a certain degree. El Duce, they just loved them for it. And it really bankrolled the Catholic Church to be able to start its reinvestment machine and such. So that today, we might talk more on this. Well, we will talk more on this. But today, the Catholic Church is probably the single most wealthiest entity. Now listen to this carefully. The single most wealthiest entity, when you take all of its land holdings, in most countries it's tax-free, all of the money they get every week, and I'll just stop here to say I looked this up on a website, that it's estimated that in America your average Catholic puts $10 in the plate on Sunday. And they multiplied it out by the number of Catholics that average go to church on Sunday in America. And it comes up to a whopping $850 million a week. But they don't have to pay tax on that. So that's tax-free income. That's just in America, that's a week, and that's just that. They are also a major stockholder in the firms, everything from IBM to GE to every one of the major stocks. They own billions of shares of stock. And in fact, it's been noted by the Wall Street Journal that in recent last couple of years that the papacy buys and sells share stocks in multitudes equal to any type of pension program of any civil government or entity, as it were, or corporation. And they do the same with gold. They buy the millions of dollars worth of gold, and they have their gold stash like all the other countries in New York and in Switzerland as well, and London. But no one knows the total wealth. They have their own bank, the Vatican Bank. It just went through a big scandal. They had to get rid of a guy, and the Italian authorities were on them. But they're not unlike the Swiss banks. They have their own accounts that people of major funds have with the Vatican Bank that's just not subject to taxation. It's not subject to peer review. There's no country to answer to. It's answering to the Vatican. The Vatican's its own country. It's just a slippery fish. It's a slippery fish, and they plan it just that way, and they've been at it an awful long time. So they actually have their, as it were, they've got their corporate representative in almost every neighborhood. Go ahead and take your church, take your parish, you divide it up the way you like, and they have their representatives. But someone was just commenting here again that the majority of the Supreme Court, and we know the Supreme Court is not elected, those nine officials are not elected officials. And now it's a majority, I think, when we say Catholic. So when they vote right now, it's like 4-4, and then they've got one swing vote, goes back and forth. Gay marriage is a big one up there right now, and we'll see which way it goes. But you have this kind of interesting perspective that Roman Catholicism is publicly positions itself as being pro-family. The evangelical Protestants position themselves as pro-family, and so as strange bedfellows, no longer protesting along these lines, they're both pro-family, and they both really want to influence the government along the lines of abortion rights, creation, education in the schools, and certainly against same-sex marriage and the transgender dilemma that's the next one coming up before. So they rally around certain similar what we would call social or moral questions. And they downplay their doctrinal differences, and that's how it's portrayed as thornians of the scroll. They can get closer together before they're all gone. They can get closer together even though they're thorny, because they're not emphasizing the thorny questions, but what they can agree on. Because in their weakness to have control, they find ways in which they can cooperate and have a greater influence. So that's that angle. I didn't know if I should start with the most recent or the oldest. Maybe I'll start with the oldest. Now, trends. This is a Time magazine cover from February 24th of 1992. And I'm really retro here. I don't have this as PowerPoint. You don't have to see this. I'll read it to you, but I'm going to hold it up. This is old-fashioned. Time magazine. Holy Alliance. How Reagan and the Pope conspired to assist Poland's solidarity movement to hasten the demise of communism. An investigative report. So what the main article of the magazine, and the French probably remember this when, you know, this first happened, was the fact that Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul had meetings at the highest levels together. They planned through the CIA to get information and money that was taken in by papal priests and others who could go from the Vatican and other places with diplomatic immunity into Poland, and they helped us encourage the Solidarity movement to really take on communism in that country. They won, and then the communism went in a downward spiral thereafter in Eastern Europe and fell apart. The most revealing part of it was this was all taking place for a number of years behind the scenes, and no one of us thought that the Pope was working with Ronald Reagan to bring down communism. We weren't even thinking, none of us were saying, hey, you know what's going on? It was after the fact. Because this was like a new thing, and it is a new thing. But it does show that there, all these world leaders that go to get their photograph with the Pope and have their interview. It could be just politics, because the Pope is considered to be the world leader of 1.2 billion Roman Catholics. 1.2 billion out of 7-some-odd billion people. That's a pretty sizable change. To be one person that's considered the head. So you're influential. But it's the system they have in place that's been in place for centuries in different areas of the country that makes them a valuable tool, and that's the way they want to be seen by certain world leaders to help accomplish what they have in mind as their goal setting. But this was one example right here, was the fall of communism. So the papacy would benefit by it. They thought the common people would benefit by it. The United States thought we would benefit by it, and they were able to bring that about. Okay. This is from March of 2015. I really came forward fast. Pope Francis. Now, the Pope mourns 21 beheaded for being people of the cross. You might remember this. This was in Libya. There, ISIS beheaded very gruesomely 21 Egyptian workers in Libya. They were poor men. They were Coptic Christians. The way the Copts, they have a tradition. They get a tattoo on their hands to show that they're a Coptic Christian. So in the middle of the night, these ISIS terrorists went into the workers' homes. They were a mix of people from Egypt, you know, different backgrounds, but they found those who had the tattoo of the being Coptic Christian, drug those 21 out, beheaded them, and what the ISIS members wrote was a message signed in blood to the people of the cross. A message signed in blood to the people of the cross. And that's what the Pope picked up on. ISIS said they killed them because they were people of the cross. Now, they were Coptic. They weren't. That's an Orthodox branch. That's not Roman Catholic. But the Pope took the position of mourning them at the public mass, made a big point of it, and he's saying they're killing the people of the cross. They're martyrs. The last words on their lips were Jesus, we're told. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but nonetheless, still, that's what took place. And then the Pope, emissaries, not himself that I know of, but the emissaries criticized President Obama because President Obama's public statement on the issue was that the United States condemned the despicable and cowardly murder of 21 Egyptian citizens. No mention of them being Christian. And that's the Pope's point. He's making a lot of hay with that. And the point is, the world leaders aren't speaking out for the Christians who are being murdered. That gives them a platform. It's very interesting because that resonates with people who aren't as discerning as we are on the doctrinal differences. We flash forward. This is a magazine. This is from April 2015. It's called Inside the Vatican. I'm a subscriber. It comes once a month because I'm keeping tabs on the enemy. And the cover artwork is, it's probably Michael the angel. He's got a sword in his hand. He's got a foot on the head of the devil. He's got him depressed. And it says, to restrain evil, disarm ISIS. Appeal of Pope Francis to halt the violence. So that's the cover story. Now, any ISIS member or Muslim was reading that, he's saying, oh, this is like the Crusades all over again. We've got the angel, got his head on Satan, and we're saying that this is disarm evil. But it's even more particular. Inside the magazine, the leading story has a picture of the Pope, and it's called A Voice for Voiceless Christians. And this story here was all about when two churches were bombed in Pakistan, two Christian churches. One was Roman Catholic, but the other one was Anglican. They were about 300 yards apart from one another. They were both bombed. Over 31 people were killed. And the Pope spoke out on that. And he went further, because then he did make a public statement, and he went on to say that Christians were being slaughtered by the Islamic radical state, and that he called on the UN to use military force to stop ISIS and the genocide of Christians. And even here in the magazine, it's going, this is very marked. For, in their mind, the greatest representative of peace and justice on earth, that call for military force against ISIS to stop them because they're slaughtering Christians. So you get the flavor of the positioning of the Pope in this, and others that can readily have a sense of righteous indignation and feel he is one who is giving it voice and publicity. And I thought it was interesting again that he basically had the same sympathy for the Anglican church that was bombed and the people killed that he did for the Roman Catholic. And he makes a point of that. He makes a point of that. He calls and he gives condolences to the different church leaders of these different denominations and branches, saying, you're our brothers that are being slain and we feel it. And we recognize you must feel it very directly in your own denomination, for lack of a better word. So there's that. This is from the World Political Advisor. World Political Advisor and Review. Under Pope Francis, Vatican flexes its global political muscle. And it's just a brief interview, and I won't go through a lot of it except just to point out that aside from the Pope himself, the main foreign policy center in the Vatican is the Secretariat of State and a network of papal envoys around the world and overseas, including nuncios, which are ecclesiastical diplomats, to the United Nations in both New York and Geneva. There's other actors, including Vatican departments, such as the Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace, and even non-Vatican bodies that sometimes perform a parallel diplomacy. And they go on. Just simple observation that they have their own networks. They are a country, but they present it from their religious perspective, but they do have very specific goals in mind. One of the things was that just this last month, the Vatican concluded a treaty recognizing the state of Palestine to exist. Well, that gave it a lot of clout with certain Arab countries along that lines, including in Palestine. Israel criticized it, but nonetheless, it's just part of this maneuvering. You would say, well, who cares what the Vatican thinks on it? Well, there are leaders that do care about it, because they do think it carries influence. Now, the recent reapproachment between the United States and Cuba, you know who the mediator for that was? It was the Pope. He brought the two back together. That's the two that they each went to. Now, think about it. Cuba is a communist country. In the United States, we've had this Cold War tension, there's political reasons, there are human rights violations, but the Pope comes in, and what does he get the kudos for? Being the peacemaker. That's exactly the kind of position he wants to be in. They want to be the mediator between world powers to accomplish things, but we know they got their agenda. So this is part of it, but you got to get in the position before you can exercise your influence. It's like getting people used to seeing you at the table. So here's now another one that I particularly thought was interesting, and that is this was back in February where they had their meeting, but the German chancellor meets with the Pope, Merkel, Now, Germany is the financial powerhouse of Europe, as we all know, and she carries a lot of weight. But she made a special trip, this article points out, she made a special trip to visit the Pope before he went on his Lenten retreat. She flew to him, specifically to catch him before he went to his Lenten retreat where he'd be unavailable. And it writes in here, they had a private audience for 40 minutes with the Pope directly. And they talked about women's suffrage, they talked about abuse of children, and they talked about the war in Ukraine. Well, you might as well call it a war. And so they had their conversation. But the point was, the timing was to be before the G7 summit that Germany just hosted. Because, and it goes on to say in this that even though they had their 40-minute meeting, which is 10 minutes longer than usual, afterwards, that's the point. Let me get to the point. Following her audience with the Pope, the second one since he was elected in 2 years, so she's seen him twice in 2 years, Merkel met Vatican Secretary of State Pedro Parolin, accompanied by Vatican Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Richard Gallagher. She also met the German ambassador to the Holy See. So the long and short of it is, it's not just a 30 or 40 minute meeting that the Pope has with the head of state. It's the subsequent meetings, now that the picture taking is over, there's the subsequent meetings with the people who actually work out policies and give influences and give their, you know, their different expressions, and they have their give and takes. Well, the Pope particularly was concerned about the Ukraine in that meeting, and he wanted to get his thoughts across. That was back in February. We come forward, the G7 meeting was just took place last week. It's been the G8 in recent years, but one wasn't invited. Remember who wasn't invited? Russia, exactly, because of their invasion into Ukraine. So Russia wasn't invited. Now we're down to the G7. So where did Putin go if he couldn't go to Germany? Yeah, he went and saw the Pope. So he goes and sees the Pope on June 11th. But the United States ambassador went and saw the Pope on June 10th. And this article just brings out that the U.S. wants the Vatican to criticize Russia more. So here again, who cares what the Pope says? He's in a position that he can act as a mediator or intermediary between opposing superpowers. So why doesn't the U.S. ambassador just go to talk to Putin himself or whatever? Well, they've had their talks. But now they want to bring the Pope in, and the Pope's willing to be there, and so they have all this background interaction together between these superpowers of trying to negotiate through a conflict that's happening in the Ukraine. And the Pope isn't just an unbiased mediator. That's where we're probably going with all this. He might be facilitating the talks, but he's being recognized in that position. So, just say all that to try to help bring out that the papacy of today, like in the French Revolution, has influence with world leaders. Not like it did exactly. No. But the world isn't exactly like it was in France. It's being handled in different ways, but nonetheless, they still are involved with the world leaders. They are the richest, probably wealthiest one single entity in the world. They do have their own program. They are trying to be more ecumenical in nature, and the way they word it is the Pope is the first among equals. So that's how they try to get around it as being partners, but still maintain their personal recognition. So in this Inside the Vatican magazine, if one flips through it, when it comes out every month, one of the things it does is it tells you the different world leaders he meets with and their interactions together, and you... Sometimes you read between the lines of what's being said, and other times it's just very plain what they get done and they're trying to accomplish. But I do think that in all of that, what we come down to in the end is that the papacy isn't gone. It's still very active in world affairs. There's over a billion of them, so that's a billion tares. And there is the Protestants on their side who has been one of the, who was one of the regular counselors to presidents, but Billy Graham, hellfire Trinitarian teacher at the Billy Graham Crusades. They still carry on in his son, but he doesn't have the same prestige, but they still have hundreds of thousands of followers and influences and groups. But Protestants have their own type of influence in their own realms. So that altogether, they still are a formidable group of individuals in the earth today, and they're bundling largely into their areas of the tares, and that's where I think we're at as far as the comparison to the French Revolution. I think what we've seen is all this is the trends leading up to the day, and I'm going to suggest that what lies ahead is the equivalent on the global scale of the 9/10 of the city compared to 1/10 of a reign of terror, which will be God's retributive judgment on papacy, on Protestantism, and all the sins against a certain amount of light that have taken place. Turn with me, please, to Revelation 6 and in verse 12. And I beheld when he opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake that's brought out already before us. This is the French Revolution. The sun became black as sackcloth and hair, and the moon became as blood. The stars of heaven fell to the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she's shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven, singular, departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. And every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men and the rich men, and the chief captains and the mighty men, and every bondsman and every free man, hid themselves in the dens in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, cover us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I heard another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, neither the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their forehead. And I heard the number of them which were to be sealed, 144,000 out of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. The French Revolution was a precursor. This is what Brother Russell's bringing out. It was like a prototype. What these verses want us to focus on is that during that French Revolution, in that period of time, there was a loss of faith in the Old and New Testament and the apostolic teachings. We see that the heaven singular, because it was only the papacy there, was rolled up as a scroll. It was set aside. It was done away. There was a great upheaval in that the mountains and islands, the republics and various governments were moved by what was taking place in France. Other governments traveled throughout Europe and other places, as it were. But they were still there. They were only moved. We see that the men from the kings of the earth who had involvement with France, not just the king of France, but kings plural, they were ill affected by this. But also, all the way down, the whole strata of society in this French Revolution, they're saying, cover us, protect us. They were looking to dens and rock, they were looking for earthly safety. And so they were hiding themselves in trade unions and various things of their day that were of an earthly nature. And they were, in essence, is this the wrath of God? They were looking at it almost like, is this the end of the world? It was so dramatic. That's what the scriptures, that's the perspective it wants us to focus on. But it says it was like a mighty wind, which can represent a lot of things, but certainly represents trouble. And the point is that it was shaking a fig tree, but untimely. In other words, it wasn't the time at this point. And I'm going to suggest that as the fig tree can represent Israel, nominal, natural Israel, I'm going to suggest here it represents nominal spiritual Israel. So nominal spiritual Israel depicted in 1/10 of the city, France, under papacy, was shaken, but it wasn't the time for its complete demise. That's why we got the papacy today. It wasn't that the French Revolution didn't do what it was supposed to do, but it was held in check. The Lord said, no, wait. This can't continue to expand out to the rest of the city. We have to put the brakes on it here because the rest of the 144,000 haven't been sealed in their foreheads at this point in time. When they are sealed, we will let off the brakes. We will let go of the four winds absolutely completely. So my retributive judgments can be the sentence passed not just on the heaven singular, papacy, but on the heavens plural, papal and Protestant, so that all that have misrepresented my character before men and have deluded men into thinking that they're Christians when they're nominal only will all be exposed and revealed and will be brought down. That's going to be the burning of the bundled tares. So no one but the true Christians, the spirit begotten, will even claim to be Christian. They'll recognize that it had been duped and they will turn against it and they will vomit it forth. But instead of just 1/10 part of the city, it's going to be the remaining 9/10 so that that whole work can go down. Now, let's take a look at Revelation 11. Revelation 11, verse 13. And this is where I'm so glad the brother had covered much of this ground. 11:13. And that hour was there a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake were slain of men 7,000, or the title of men, 7,000. And the remnant were affrighted, gave glory to the God of heaven. In the French Revolution, it suggested, I couldn't prove it, but I read that some feel that 7,000 titles of nobility and such were eliminated in the French Revolution. Probably includes some of the clerical standings. But it's the 10th part of the city. That's already been discussed. Now let's take that information to Revelation 16. Revelation 16. We have our verse in, as the theme text in verse 16, gathering them together to the place in the Hebrew tongue called Armageddon. And we see that, brethren, you're so familiar with this. You know that back in 13 that we see that there was a three unclean frogs like spirits coming out of the mouth of the dragon, civil power, out of the beast, that's the ten-horned beast, papacy, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, federated Protestants. Brother Russell explains that so well in the 1912 forward to the fourth volume. They're all on the same page saying at least the same thing. They're trying to pull together and hold the city condition together. And that in effect though gets them to the place of the Armageddon crash. And the Armageddon crash is the seventh plague, which follows. And so when we read down in verse 18, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since there were men on the earth, so mighty and so great. And the great city was divided into three parts. And the cities, King James plural, but in the Greek singular, and the city of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath, and every island fled away. Not just moved, fled away. And the mountains were not found. Not just moved, the mountains were not found. So, just stopping here, the point would be is that as the French Revolution was a prototype of what took place, what the greater crescendo is going to be is when there's a great revolution over Christendom, and we call it Christendom, only because they still feel that they have the right to get their people in the positions to govern. That's the angle. They still feel they have the right and the duty to get Christians in the position of governing. And that, I think, is what the three parts of the city are, was that false prophet, the federated Protestants, the papists, and the government working together. And it must be under great duress because the world will probably have a partial financial collapse. That's speculation, but it's based on James 5, 1 through 10. A partial financial collapse, terrorism, the threat of ISIS, the threat of Islam, the threat of climatic problems, all these different issues reach a crescendo to finally bring the people of Europe and the United States into a condition of saying, we'd rather have a form of stability like the good old days, not remembering the horrors, than we would just going into anarchy and have it all fall apart. You know, your average man just wants to be able to go home to his family and have food on the table, heat if it's cold, cool if it's hot, and a sense that someone's not kicking in their door and going to come in and kill them. They don't care if it's communist. They really don't care if it's democratic. They certainly don't care, If it's someone that's going to, unless they're providing and protecting. That's what they're in. That's what the average person doesn't care about, the ideology. So when that takes place, I think we're in that position where you have that 1 hour of power. Revelation 17. Revelation 17 and verse 12. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings. Now this is very similar. We've got France was 1/10 of the city. So this is the same kind of a picture talking about what we're calling Christendom, even though we know it's not the 1914 Christendom. It says, thou sawest ten kings which have received no kingdom as yet. Well, that's true. Because 1914 removed the old kings. These are kings that are after 1914. These aren't monarchical kings. These would be the kings of government of today and finance. But they receive power 1 hour with the beast, and they give their mind and power over to the beast. 1 hour. Very short period of time. Then we drop down to verse 16, and it does says, the ten horns, which you saw, and the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and to give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled, and the woman which you saw is that great city, which reigneth over the kings of the earth. So, the point is, in the end, the beast represents the body of the people that have been governed over. The people rise up against it, just like during the French Revolution. The ten horns were the powers, were the kings, the governments, the financial leaders. They too will turn against it after they see the people turn against it. Just like in the French Revolution, things went from bad to worse. And they end up, she's going to be burned with fire. There's going to be this utter destruction. So that the earthquake that we read about, the great earthquake of Revolution, is actually going to dissolve into anarchy. There's no island republics or mountains governments that are going to come up in place of this earthquake. It goes into anarchy, and the only replacement is going to be the fifth universal empire of Christ's kingdom. So I've exceeded my time, and I just want to, in closing, relate that many of the parallels of the events that we saw leading up to the French Revolution, in just a very brief way, we certainly see those trends are continuing today. But if I was to sum it up in just the most simple way, is that it tells us that the seven last plagues contain the fullness of the wrath of God. And with papacy having such a public position today, 2 billion people still believing a false concept about the character of God, we do believe that God's retributive justice requires that a more thorough and absolute and complete overthrow and expose of these falsehoods will be accomplished, and will be accomplished in such a way that it will leave no doubt of God's displeasure over those Antichrist system and all that they represented.